Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Film Spotting SVU is presented by Movies on Demand on cable, bringing the latest indie movies into your home at the touch of a button.
Right now, you can watch Addicted to Fame, a movie that profiles the making of Anna Nicole Smith's last film, available the same day that it hits theaters. Also available is The Central Park 5, available on demand during its theatrical release.
The latest independent films are ready when you are with Movies on Demand on cable. The art house is now in your house.
From New York City, this is Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit. I'm Matt Singer.
And I'm Allison Wilmore. Except, I've been meaning to tell you, Matt, that this whole time you've known me, I've actually in reality been a 40-year-old French con man lying about my identity in order to find a podcast to serve as a loving home I always wanted. And as a place for us to discuss Bart Layton's documentary, The Imposter.
I always thought there was something strange about your accent. California, my foot. Later, we'll bring you Q Shots, our look at some of the current offerings on various streaming and VOD sites, all centered around a common theme. In honor of The Imposter, we thought we'd take a look at some other uses of reenactments in film and TV, but that led us to watching hours and hours of America's Most Wanted. After which we decided, you know, maybe we'll just look at some more of this year's new releases available on streaming and rental sites.
But first up is Opening Break, a segment we do in conjunction with our sponsor, Movies on Demand on Cable, in which we spotlight one title that's new on VOD and give you a rundown of a few other notable films on demand on cable. Matt, what's our first pick this week?
Our first pick this week is a very interesting film entitled King Kelly, which is directed by Andrew Neil. And this would probably be described as a found footage movie, although technically this footage, I think, was never lost. We might need to come up with a new name for this sort of thing. Is it a POV film? Is it a camera phone film? Is it a first-person film? I don't know. I don't know if found footage is accurate, but that's probably what it is.
I mean, like, the character who's shooting it intends to use it. There's never any doubt that, like, this footage will be stored away somewhere to be discovered.
Right. So anyway, it's technically a found footage movie because every single shot in the movie is recorded by the characters on screen. And there's a certain sort of formal rigor to the gimmick in this movie. I don't know if we've ever talked about it on the podcast before, Allison, but I know we've talked about it with other people, how frustrated I get with found footage movies that cheat with the gimmick. A good example recently would be the film End of Watch, which I liked. It was an interesting movie, had some very good lead performances from the two main actors. But they establish this found footage gimmick where one of the characters is making a film for a film studies class about his day job as a cop. So he's got some handheld cameras, he has some cameras on his lapels, and they establish all this in the very first scene. In the very next scene, they just throw it all right out the window. There's cameras everywhere. There's got to be 20 angles in that next scene, which happens in like a briefing room. And I'm sitting there going, you just went into all this trouble to explain what we're about to see and set up the rules. And it didn't take you 30 seconds to break it. That drives me crazy. I don't know if you feel the same way, Allison, but I hate that.
Yeah.
In this case, though, we've got a movie that is really rigid about it and kind of believable, too. The main character is this self-obsessed young woman. I don't know if they ever say her age, but she's still living at home. She's probably like late teens,
yeah, 21,
early 20s.
I would guess, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And she owns her own, or she works in a porn chat room where she performs sex acts on herself for tips from guys who are watching online. She calls herself King Kelly. She has this whole sort of persona about herself. And then on this one particular day, which I think is not coincidentally the 4th of July, her whole world starts to fall apart. In her spare time, Kelly works as a drug mule for a local dealer. And when a friend takes back her car, which is really his car that she sort of borrowed permanently, it's got drugs inside that she needs to deliver to someone. So she has to set off with a friend on this crazy day and night of partying and searching for the drugs and taking other drugs and constantly filming themselves while they do it. And then uploading the videos they shoot to Facebook and then filming the reactions to those videos when they're posted on Facebook and people comment on them on Facebook. It's like this crazy kind of feedback loop. Most found footage movies use the gimmick as a gimmick. You know, it adds realism or immediacy, like in the case of End of Watch. I think it's there more to do nothing more than to just really lend this sort of like documentary-esque sense of realism to it. In the case of King Kelly, it's a gimmick as social commentary, basically, about this generation of kids who are obsessed with their phones. And I don't think King Kelly's nickname is an accident. I think that she, in her mind, thinks of herself as like celebrity royalty, you know, and that's how she portrays herself on her camera phone movies that she's constantly taking. And I found the movie really interesting in that, in its aesthetic, in the way that it used the found footage thing to comment on this generation of Americans who are so self-obsessed that it's, you know, they're like destroying themselves little by little.
Hi, this is King Kelly, and I had some crazy stuff happen to me last 4th of July. I made an awesome movie. It's my movie, and I'm about to be famous. Everything was going fine. I was about to launch my website. I was getting tons of fans for my online exotic dancing thing.
Happy birthday, George Washington.
Then my loser ex-boyfriend Ryan stole my car. My retarded sister Angela got all up in my business. Big drama.
You have a real problem.
My biffle Jordan got mad at me at Dean's Rager. It was her boyfriend, but nothing really happened.
Oh my God.
Jordan, it's not what you think.
She got over it.
Allison, I know you saw the movie too. Did you like it?
I did like it. And I think it also, it says something very interesting about how you can use the internet for a mirror for affirmation. Like, you can always find people who will tell you, you know, that they like what you're doing or that they, you know, are a fan.
Yes.
I think, depending on how you present yourself.
The threshold for, like, being a great artist or a great celebrity is so low.
Right. And so she is a pretty terrible person, but has gotten so much kind of praise from this very narrow group of people she's found as her fan base, that it's like created this kind of artificial sense of like confidence and entitlement.
Yes.
And it's really interesting how the film plays with that.
Yes.
And how kind of damaging it can be.
Right. And how towards the end of the movie, without stripping it away, it destroys that self-confidence.
Yes.
But at the end, there's this amazing monologue too, where it almost like reaffirms her King Kelly-ness.
Yeah.
I love that last scene of the movie. I think it's one of the best scenes in any movie this year, really. I've seen it a few times, the movie, and I love that scene. So that's King Kelly, and it will be available on VOD starting on December 4th.
Two more picks for you. These are both documentaries. I haven't had a chance to see either yet, but I'm really interested in seeing them. They both are very, like, highly acclaimed. So the first is Ai Weiwei, Never Sorry, which is Alison Clayman's documentary about the Chinese artist and activist. And it takes a look at his work over 2 years and his clashes with the government. And this doc has gotten a lot of attention. It won the special jury prize at the Sundance Film Festival earlier this year. And it's always very interesting to take a look at a figure, particularly like this, who's brought a lot of international attention to human rights issues in China and, you know, is also an artist, a very respected artist in his own right. So that is available on VOD on December 4th. And the other film is Crazy Horse, which is about the legendary Parisian cabaret, which features nude dance shows, but has also kind of made itself a like, respectable tourist stop, you know, as the years have gone by, as much as like your more typical Parisian landmarks. But this is a film directed by the great Frederick Wiseman, who is really one of the most influential documentarians, you know, out there. And it offers a behind-the-scenes look at the place, at rehearsals, and the development of a new show by a famous choreographer. And, you know, Wiseman is always really interesting at when he documents process. So I'm very intrigued by that. And that is available on VOD on December 11th.
So we were debating a theme for Cue Shots this week. We were kind of debating a few things. But then it seemed like, this is, you know, it's December now, Allison.
It is.
And at this time of year, especially early December, there's really one thing on any critic's mind, which is their top 10 list, seeing as many films as they can, trying to catch up with movies they've missed. And why pretend like we're interested in older films right now when we're not, when we don't have the time to watch older movies, when we really need to keep watching newer stuff or thinking about movies that we've already seen and considering them again. So that's why we thought, since we're doing a new movie, this is a movie that was released earlier this year, The Impostor, that's our main Listener's Choice review, why not just talk about some other movies? And maybe before we get started, the one sort of general thing we can talk about is, do you have, and Allison, when you're making your list, do you have any rules when you're making your top 10 list, like, I need to have at least 5 foreign films, or I want to make sure that I have a couple of mainstream titles, or I want my 10th pick to be something no one would ever expect to see on a top 10 list. I know people, I'm not saying you do, but yeah. I know people who've said all of those sorts of things to me. I want to have a mix of foreign and you know, U.S. films. I want to try to create a couple of things that, you know, make people think, like, they have a very sort of didactic approach to a top 10 list. Other people are just like, these are my 10 favorite movies, and that's it. Some people like to do an order, 1 through 10. Some people prefer not to have an order. They have a alphabetical or whatever just to try to make it more equal or something like that. So what about you? What how do you do it? How do you approach it? Do you have any rules?
I definitely put them in order. I feel like if you don't put them in order,
it's
then
cheating,
why even
right?
bother?
Yeah, it's totally, it's a cop out.
Exactly.
It sucks. I agree with you. It sucks to have to do. And right now, I won't say which two movies, but right now for my number 1 and 2, I've got 2 candidates. And I have no idea. I still, like, every day I go back and forth as I'm looking at the list, as I'm watching new movies, and I'm looking at my potential list, I'm going, which is going to be my number 1? And I really don't know. And this year, I could eat, like, if I was a cheater, I could have a 1 and 1A or something.
Oh, absolutely not.
Yeah,
though.
It's no good. I'm going to have to come down. And the hardest part, though, is I don't know if I'm going to be able to see either one again before the list. So that's going to be tough. Anyway, I'm sorry. Keep going.
No, I mean, I don't have, like, a kind of, I know some people who will go unmentioned, but who have, like, numerical systems, like, they keep throughout, like, as soon as they see a movie, rate the movie.
Yes.
And that, like, puts, that's how they would do like a top 10 list, would be basically on that. I'm not nearly so scientific, or, you know, I think my approach is pretty holistic. Like, I look back at the year and kind of, you know, it's difficult when you've seen something sometimes, like, in, like, a year or two ago, if at a festival.
Right, that's true. You could have seen a film at Cannes 2011, and it's eligible for top 10 list this year, because generally the way that these things work is when the movie was released theatrically is when it counts for a top 10 list. So yeah, a movie could premiere at a festival a year ago. You might not have seen it since then, and you've got to weigh it against a movie you saw yesterday. I mean, that's tough. That's not easy to do.
I mean, I think I tend to end up with a relatively varied list, but that's just, I think, because I see a lot of movies. I am definitely going to top out 200 new releases this year easily. You know, I think probably I'm going to come out around 250, which is horrifying. But, you know, I think that just ends up including a lot of varied films. And I think, you know, it reflects your taste, whether or not you skew, like, very mainstream. But I've never tried to, like, deliberately mix things up. So,
all right. As we sit here on Sunday, December 2nd, you've got probably about a week before you have to submit to these, to the polls. There's these national polls for the Village Voice and IndieWire. They come first, and then, you know, obviously you have to do your own top 10. Do you have, like I was saying, I'm debating between 2 different films right now. Do you have a clear number 1? Do you have
I haven't started yet.
You haven't started
no,
at all.
No, there are a few other films that I want to watch before I start. I mean, I've had certain years, I've had something skate in to take my number 1 spot that I saw very late in the year.
But you don't have, like, a running list
I
at
do
all.
Not.
You don't,
no. I
you
know
don't
that
keep
you
a
do.
List of contenders. You just go through the year and then
no, I'm going to take it, like, a
you
few
sit
hours
down
and
one day
sit down.
And just go, okay. And how do you determine what it's like, whatever comes to your mind? How do you determine what, do you look back at what you've reviewed? How do you figure out?
I look
out?
Back at the year calendar, at you, the giant year calendar, and then I pull out stuff that I've seen that I know is a contender, and then I'll have, like, a list from there, and then I'll start sorting. But yeah,
I don't know if anyone listening cares about this, but I find this absolutely fascinating.
Because you do something very different. You keep a list throughout the year, right?
Yes, and it's not, like, set in stone, but I do sort of keep a running list, at least of, like, you know, like, these are the movies that are up for the top 10, and then as new movies come in, I sort of move things down, and then there's, like, an honorable mention list. That doesn't necessarily mean that by the end of the, like, things can move around, because I'll rewatch something, and I'll go, oh, this is better than I thought, or this doesn't really hold up to a second viewing. So, but yes, I do sort of keep a running list, and my memory is so bad. I don't know how I'd remember some of those movies that I saw at Fantastic Fest last year if I wasn't keeping a running list. So I don't know. That's how I do it. Anyway, I don't know that necessarily these new movies that we're talking about, at least in my case, there's a pretty good chance that none of these three are going to be up on my top 10 list.
Okay.
However, I think these are all 3 very good movies, and I think they will wind up on some people's top 10 list. So I think these are good movies to catch. I think these are good movies to see, to be part of sort of the end of the year conversation. All 3 of these movies will wind up on some top 10 lists.
Yes, I agree with my picks as well.
Same thing. Okay, well, why don't you start? Give us your first new release.
Okay, my first new release is, these are actually all 3 of mine are streaming on Netflix.
Okay,
but this is The Deep Blue Sea, It was originally a 2011 film that came out in the U.S. in 2012, directed by Terrence Davies of Distant Voices, Still Lives, The Long Day Closes. Not to be confused with the Rennie Harlan movie in which a mutant shark eats Samuel L. Jackson mid-rant. This is an adaptation of a 1952 play by Terrence Rattigan that Davies has turned into this really kind of beautiful, impressionistic take on what's basically a love triangle. It's about a love triangle. It stars a terrific Rachel Weisz as the wife of a judge who falls in love with a younger man who was a pilot in World War II. He's played by Tom Hiddleston of, you know, Thor. And she gives up this stable and very affectionate, if not particularly passionate, upper class life for this young man who is, I think, and what's one of the most interesting things about the film, he is both like dashing, this dashing attractive figure, and also clearly a very shallow one. And she's kind of consumed by him, but he does not love her in that way. So she gives up this life, goes to live in this rooming house with him, and is miserable in certain ways, but also can't stay away from him. So it portrays this really interesting sense of like just being torn between what you know is the kind of sensible choice and then what is this very unhappy passion, but like a passion that's irresistible nonetheless.
Could you arrange something special?
Just steak and a bottle of claret.
I'm sorry. Come on. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. I can't say any more, can I?
No. You can't.
And, you know, Weisz really is pretty incredible in this. The film is very consumed with this certain era in England after the war, and it's very much about these like tamped down emotions, but it is very underneath that there is this real sense of emotional rawness, particularly since the film starts off with Weisz's character attempting suicide and then flashes back and forth to fill out her situation and how she ended up there. So that is The Deep Blue Sea, and it is available for streaming on Netflix.
But no mutant sharks?
No, though, I mean, maybe an after credits edition. Mutant shark comes out and eats everyone.
I'm not interested then. No, I'm just kidding. I've heard great things about it. I think actually Adam Kempinar from Film Spotting Original Recipe is a big fan of that movie as well. And I saw that it popped up on Netflix. That's one I've got to see before I finish my own top 10 list. Okay, mm-hmm. My first pick is Sound of My Voice. This is a good example of what you were talking about earlier, Allison. This film premiered at Sundance in 2011. So if you saw it there but haven't had a chance to see it again, this is almost 2 years since you saw it. And technically, it came out earlier this year in a theatrical release, so it counts as a 2012 film. It's directed by Zal Batmanglij, and it is available on Amazon Instant and iTunes, Vudu, YouTube, Google Play, you name it. It's available on most rental services online. The movie is starring and co-written by a young woman named Britt Marling. She burst onto the indie film scene at Sundance 2011. She had two different indie sci-fi projects that she co-wrote and starred in there. The first one was called Another Earth. That was about a woman who's grappling with this mistake in her past. She suddenly discovers, along with the rest of the world, that there's this identical Earth floating in the sky, and it presents all sorts of questions. And then the second film, which I actually preferred greatly to the other one, is Sound of My Voice. Came out earlier this year from Fox Searchlight. It's less overtly science fiction-y. It's more like a sci-fi film crossed with a detective story set in the world of religious cults. She, in this case, Britt Marling, plays really the crucial supporting role here. This woman named Maggie, who's the head of this group, who meet in this nondescript suburban basement where she counsels them, and the two newest members of the group are secretly undercover filmmakers who are hoping to expose her as a fraud. But as they get drawn deeper and deeper into the group, they start to think maybe her story is true, and that she claims that she traveled back in time to save these people from this impending apocalypse. And though it seems outrageous on the surface, they start to believe it a little bit.
It's a really dark time. Every life is a death.
We'll be all right, though. Maggie's taking us to a safe place.
Why do you have a gun?
It is very important that we trust each other. We're family now.
I just feel like we're in over our heads.
Yeah, that's investigative journalism.
If you'll come with me, please, Peter, Maggie will see you.
I know some people were very frustrated by the smallness of this movie. It really almost entirely takes place in this one beige carpeted basement with no furnishings. I mean, it is very low rent in that sense. And I know some people didn't like the open-ended nature of the ending, but I actually thought both of those things were why I liked it. I mean, those were both things that I would say were in the movie's favor. I mean, to me, this is just a great example of what an indie film can do with small budget or no budget at all. I mean, this is a story that takes that weakness and turns it into a strength by making it about this idea of belief. You know, any person who's in a cult is there because they believe in this person that is telling them these things. And so by making this movie set in this basement where we don't see the future, we don't see any of these things we're being told, and we have to go on faith, it puts us in the position of the cult members, which I thought was a really smart way of making this movie. And the same thing about the open-ended ending here. It's like, what do you believe? I don't know if they're planning on making more of these movies or a TV show. I would want to return to this world. I would want to see more movies, more anything about these characters, because I think they're so rich and so interesting. So that's Sound of My Voice, and it's now available on, you name it, and it is available on it for rental.
My next pick is maybe the opposite. It is very not small. It's big and sprawling. It is Once Upon a Time in Anatolia, which is streaming on Netflix, directed by Nuri Bilge Ceylan. I think I'm saying that right. I'm sorry if I'm not. It's who is a director who's responsible for really, actually, some of the most like remarkable shot compositions and visuals of anyone working today, I think. But who's the content of his films, I sometimes find problematic. There's sometimes they just feel almost like a parody of an art film, which has always been something that's held me back watching them. But Once Upon a Time in Anatolia, I actually really love, though it's a film that I have to say is incredibly not suited to streaming. It is 157 minutes long and very deliberately slow. Matt, I know that you gave this one a try too, and you
I watched it. Well, you will discuss. Okay. You go through it, but yes, I watched it last night for
yes.
the first time.
Okay. You know, it's a film that actually even I saw it for the first time at the New York Film Festival last year. And it was, at the time, I felt like almost a little trying, but it was one that I just couldn't get off my mind afterwards. I was really haunted by it and went back and revisited it and liked it more, even more then. So it's a film that takes place over a night in which a doctor is traveling around with a team of police and a prosecutor and a man who has confessed to murder. They're driving around the countryside in Anatolia. The murderer is going to show them where he buried the body, except that he was drunk at the time. So he's having trouble remembering where that is. You know, it's like in a field somewhere. It's by certain, like a tree. It's not really close to any landmarks that are easy to describe, especially when he was, you know, under the influence at the time. So they, over the course of this night, they kind of drive through and they talk as they hope to find this body. And it is in this really kind of meditative way. It is, it does seem to acquire this curious profundity. It seems like it's almost a film equivalent of, you know, when you have these long nights where you feel like you're almost grasping some particular truth of existence. And I think like the film is very, has a lot of empathy. I mean, the crime in question, as you learn more about it over the course of the film, even it seems like very, your understanding of it, of these people, kind of turns, and of the place itself. You know, the title "Once Upon a Time in Anatolia" brings to mind some like Sergio Leone westerns, and it's shot in CinemaScope and has like some incredible visuals, even at night, because it's got a lot of these shots of like these cars winding their way through the countryside. There's like hilly countryside, or just like headlights on like grassy fields that really aren't like anything that don't recall anything I've really seen before. But Matt, I want to hear your experience with it.
Well, it's not like I was forced to watch this movie. I was really looking forward to it.
Yeah.
And I knew it was long and I was prepared for it to be a very slow and deliberate film. And like, I went out of my way to like give myself a night where I was like, I had nothing else to do. I put my phone away. I put all distractions away. I gave myself over to the movie. I do agree it is gorgeous, and you know, even on streaming, it's an HD stream of it on Netflix. It does look really good. The movie is gorgeous to look at. I don't know if I needed to look at quite so much of it, and I didn't feel like that the length was necessarily justified in terms of the insights that I gleaned from it. There were some things about it I liked. There were some performances I liked. There's one particular character, the prosecutor who is involved, who tells this sort of two-part story about a case that he was involved in that I thought was very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of it, and I get that it is about sort of like the deliberate pace of life in this world, mm-hmm. and the way that crimes, the way they get solved or not solved, as the case may be, is like so incredibly slowly. But it's interesting that you say that some of his other films felt to you like a parody of an art film. At times, that's what I felt like I was watching. I felt like it was almost a parody because it was so deliberate.
Yeah, this feels much more human and grounded to me than his like.
Right. I'm not so familiar with his other work, so I can't really compare it to his other films. But that just the way you described it.
Yeah.
I thought. Look, I'm one person. I wouldn't say I disliked it. Mm-hmm. I would say that it's worth seeing, but as you also said, and let's move on after this, I would not necessarily recommend it on streaming. This is a tough film to watch at home, especially like on your computer. You know, you really have to shut off the world if you're going to watch this movie because it is very deliberate, it's very slow, it's very quiet. You can't be checking your cell phone. You can't be checking your Twitter feed while you're doing it. So not the best film to watch on streaming.
Yeah,
probably
it's
better.
It's a tough ask.
Better in the theatrical world. All right, my next pick is a little bit. Well, I was going to say lighter, but actually it's incredibly dark as well. But it's not quite as long. It's a little bit more engrossing, I think. It's called Kill List. It's directed by a young man named Ben Wheatley, and this is available also on a variety of rental services, including Amazon, iTunes, Google Play, and YouTube. And like Sound of My Voice, this is another film, and maybe this is it's time to write a think piece, Allison, we're one away. It's like sort of an interesting genre hybrid, right? It's sort of a hitman movie mixed with a domestic drama. And then there's some other stuff at the end that I won't spoil that's sort of from a different genre altogether. And it's about this guy who's an experienced mercenary, hitman, soldier type. He's been sort of shaken or upset by some undiscussed job in the recent past, but he's got bills piling up. And he's got to do something. He has to provide for his family, his wife, and his child. So he's convinced by his partner to do one last job. Guess what, Allison? That one last job, it doesn't go quite as planned.
That's the last time.
It's enough for him. Not an insult.
No, he's just taking the piss.
It's a cat. Can't take the piss.
Where is it? Oh, no, Jay.
Rabbit.
Oh, put it in the outside bin.
Fuck am I. We'll cook it up with some onion and garlic.
No, not in my kitchen.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I'll just get rid of it, babe. Oh.
Smell of that.
As I said already, this is a very dark movie. It is disturbing in the extreme. It is violent. It is it's a little bloody, but even more than that, just the ideas are really disturbing. But it really hits you right in the gut, and it's kind of an awesome allegory for just sort of like the economic crisis that we've gone through in recent years in general. You know, like what is someone willing to do for their family? You know, you can say, I wouldn't do that, I wouldn't do this, but when the bills are piling up and you have to do something, what are you going to do? It's a movie about selling out, you know? It's a movie about doing something for money and what that feels like, and then what you try to do to overcompensate in the other direction when you're selling out. And again, just really disturbing and haunting. Have you seen Kill List,
Allison? I thought I'd heard very good things about it.
Oh, now you're going to come at me now.
No, I think that it's got a lot of really great pieces to it, including some very disturbing imagery towards the end.
Yes.
Like, the end is really well done.
Yes.
And I think the combination of, like, very deliberately banal domestic dramas and then these very disturbing and violent hits, it creates for an interesting tension. And in some ways, though there's very little I think they have in common, there's almost a sense of like a Wicker Man style. Like it has that.
It has a touch of the Wicker Man.
A touch of the Wicker Man, not just in like some thematic things, but just in how it feels. It has
tonally.
Like things are going slightly wrong and you don't understand what it is yet.
But I absolutely agree. There's definitely a little bit of that there.
Yeah. But I don't think it quite came together for me. Uh-huh. I didn't feel like a whole to me at the end. It just felt like a lot of kind of great ideas that didn't cohere.
All right. Well, we'll have to see who we've got a real diverse opinion this week. We'll have to see who the listeners side with. Do you side with Allison and Anatolia or Matt and Killis? They're very, very different styles of film there. All right. What are our last, what's your last pick?
My last pick is a doc. I wanted to throw a doc in here. It is Jiro Dreams of Sushi, which is also streaming on Netflix, directed by David Gelb. And it is a portrait of Jiro Ono, who is a famous sushi chef who is 85 years old. He runs a sushi restaurant that has been given 3 Michelin stars, which is like the kind of achievement that is given to very few restaurants in the world. And particularly one that is like a 10-seat restaurant that's in a train station, which is what this is. And that costs at least $300. Prices start at $300 for a person. And the meal can take as little as 15 minutes if you're just sitting there because he makes, it's like sushi in the very like kind of most lean sense. You know, you get made a piece of sushi and you eat it, then another one and you eat it.
You're sitting like at the sushi bar. In front of, like, he's right in front of you and he's just handing them to you.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it's a pretty fascinating portrait of like sushi making and an art that is very defined by tradition and by this pursuit of perfection. You know, in like sushi is a collection of fairly, especially the type of sushi that Jiro makes, is a collection of like very simple ingredients. So it's all just about perfection within this combination and within finding your ingredients and making them the right way. I think that this film is really a great exploration of, I mean, one, just the idea of passing this legacy along. Like, you know, there's a really interesting story in which the sons, Jiro has 2 sons. You're like, how do you contend with the reputation of your father, who is this great artist, you know, like, can you take over the business? Like, are you just going to be like burdened by this reputation? And then also just the idea of this pursuit of artistic greatness, even within this world of, you know, sushi making, that it's this incredibly bittersweet thing in a way, because it means constantly being dissatisfied. It's a really, it's a great doc, whether you're a fan of sushi or not. It's a great portrait of someone. That is Jiro Dreams of Sushi. It is streaming on Netflix.
Yeah, that's it. Okay, we can agree on one film, I'm glad. My last pick, very quickly here, is this is also available on Netflix. It's a film entitled Oslo, August 31st, directed by, I'm going to guess his first name's pronounced Joachim, like Joaquin Phoenix, Joachim Trier. He's actually, I think, a cousin of Lars von Trier. They are related. he's made a couple of films. This is his latest film, a very powerful, another dark movie. We've got some really dark films. Another potential think piece on 2012, Allison. Not a lot of brightness and sunshine amongst our picks this week. It's about a day in the life of a 34-year-old recovering drug addict. Have you seen this movie, Allison?
I have not. I've seen Reprise, his previous film, and I've heard really good things about this one, but haven't seen it yet.
Man, it opens with just an absolute punch in the gut. We meet this character who's our protagonist, and he's in a hotel room, and then he's walking. He leaves and he starts walking. He goes into a forest. He finds a lake, and there's no dialogue at all. And he just fills his – I don't think this is a spoiler. This is the first scene of the movie. Fills his pockets with rocks and just walks into this lake to try to kill himself. And the camera follows him without cutting and stays above the water, and then we're just watching the surface of the water as seconds tick by and tick by and tick by. And then finally he comes up for air. either having decided or failed, depending on your perspective, to kill himself. And the rest of the movie is sort of like, metaphorically, is this guy going to be able to keep his head above the water, essentially? He lives in a rehab facility. He's a recovering drug addict, and he has a job interview in Oslo that day. And so he travels into the city, and while he's waiting for the interview, he goes to meet some old friends, and then he goes to a party, and then he travels around. And even more than drug addiction or substance abuse, what it's really about is the fact that this guy is now like in his mid-30s. And even if he's sort of recovered from his addiction, he's looking around at friends who are now, you know, who he used to party with. They're married with kids and careers, and he has nothing. And it's that question of, well, at what point can you start your life over? And is there a point past which you can't? All of those questions make for a very sad film, but also, you know, a really beautiful one. I mean, it's a really emotional, empathetic look at this character who is really suffering, and the main performance really gets that across. So I would recommend, Allison, you see this one before Top 10 List time if you can. I know your time is money here, but this is a really, really good film. It's called Oslo, August 31st. It's available on Netflix.
We're happy to announce that we have a new sponsor this week. It is MoviePass, which is a new subscription service in which you pay a monthly fee and then you can see a movie per day at many major theaters. You check in using an app on your smartphone and use a membership card, and it works for any new release, though it doesn't cover 3D or IMAX yet.
I've been using mine. Allison, we both got them. Have you gotten a chance to try yours out yet?
Not yet.
Okay, well, I've used mine several times and it works great. If you're a frequent moviegoer or you know a frequent moviegoer, MoviePass is a service that could make a lot of sense to you. Rather than paying per ticket, you just pay that flat fee for the month, and that will get you your entry into one film per day. So you no longer need to feel guilty for shelling out to see Breaking Dawn Part 2 for the third time. I don't know why anyone would feel guilty. I'd be proud, but nevertheless, if you wanted to see Breaking Dawn 30 times in 30 days, you would just have to pay that one flat monthly
and,
fee.
And, you know, it would probably come out very affordably. But
absolutely.
MoviePass is currently invite only, but, you know, we've got you hooked up. So they're currently offering a limited number of subscriptions to Film Spotting and Film Spotting SVU listeners, including 30-day, 90-day, and year-long gift packages for the holidays. You can check out moviepass.com/filmspotting for more info and to get $10 off the second month of your subscription.
Just gotta go get him and get him back here where he's safe.
I didn't see how I could not document him as a U.S. citizen.
We had no idea what kind of person we were getting. They look very different.
He disappeared without a trace 3 years ago. Tonight, a San Antonio boy is back home.
When a child is missing for years, either the child is dead or the child is not found.
He was tortured. I mean, he had torture written on.
This kid's really messed up.
There was just something wrong about it.
Something was being hidden, and I didn't know what that was.
Our listener's choice pick this episode is The Imposter, which is available on VOD and iTunes. Directed by Bart Layton in his feature directorial debut, Layton is, interestingly, the creator and executive producer of the reality show Locked Up Abroad.
Huh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's about, you know, travelers who end up getting arrested while in foreign countries for various things. Makes a lot of sense, actually, in just in kind of how it...
Stylistically?
Yeah, it influences this. The Imposter is a film about Frédéric Bourdin, who is a French con man who, in a series of extraordinary coincidences and developments in 1997... ends up impersonating Nicholas Barclay, who was a San Antonio boy who disappeared in 1994 when he was 14 years old or 13 years old. Bourdin has a history of faking his identity and passing himself off as a kid when, at the time of this incident, he was already 23 years old. But that's not the only problem and the only thing that makes this such a great and incredible story. Nicholas was blonde and blue-eyed. Bourdin has brown eyes and brown hair and an accent. And oh yes, he was in Spain at the time that he kind of tried to pass himself off as this kid he turned up. This name, basically, is all he knew in Texas. But Barclay's family, his mother, his sister, they take him in. They take this kid in. They go to retrieve him from Spain and take him in without question. This European man with a growth of beard passing himself off as a blonde teenager. Now, the film uses home movie footage, newsreel footage, and some really interestingly staged reenactments to tell this story. But the heart of the film are really its interviews, particularly the ones with Bourdain, the ones with Nicholas's mother, Beverly Dollarhide, his sister, Carrie Gibson, also Nancy Fisher, the FBI agent who handled the case, and Charlie Parker, who is a private investigator who just basically got caught up and was the one who was like, really? This is really happening? But as the film goes along, all of these people start to seem like different degrees of unreliable or biased narrators as the details come out. So, Matt, my first question for you is what you thought of Bourdain, because he is relating this kind of incomprehensible action, and he is the central figure of the film. Did you find him just creepy throughout, or did you ever find him sympathetic? Because he talks a little bit about his motivations, and he says that they're coming from a kind of a troubled past.
Yeah. That's not really a fair question for me to answer, because I, knowing a little bit around the events of the film, I had heard about him, and I've heard that apparently people who, like, write negative reviews of him in about this movie, like if they say that he's a con man or he's a terrible person, he's taken to Twitter to attacking them and saying horrible things. For all I know, after he hears this, he may attack us. So I found him hard to say, after hearing that and his sort of lack of remorse in that sense, and in the movie in general for the most part, I didn't necessarily find him a sympathetic figure. I found him a fascinating figure for sure, and it is a fascinating and unbelievable story in so many ways. But I don't know if I ever sympathized with him. Did you? Were you sympathizing with him?
No, I mean, he is fascinating, though. I really, like, it's his, like, incredibly disturbing approach and kind of aura that I think is what one of the things that makes this movie so interesting, mm-hmm. is that, like, he talks about having basically going in search of the childhood he never got, like the loving right. childhood he never got.
Right.
And there is something really poignant about the idea of that you could basically somehow be like, I want to start over. I'm going to pass myself off as a 14-year-old
sure.
so that I can be a kid again.
Yes.
And, you know, and I do appreciate that. But he is on screen, like, very creepy, really.
Yeah.
Like, as he talks very openly about, I think, and especially given that his English is like a little off, when he says that part about talking to the sister and talking about how he's Nicholas, and he says, I washed her brain, which I thought was just like, you know, really memorable
yeah.
and tough to kind of deal with approach or just thing to say. But I what did you think of the way that the film matches up the reenactments? Because that was one of the things I thought it did really well, is it has a lot of reenactments, sometimes using Bourdain, but it also matches them up so that there's sometimes people are speaking or lip syncing essentially
yes.
along to an interview.
Right. So Bourdain or someone else will be talking, and then we'll see the actor in the reenactment lip syncing their words. You know, we don't hear their voices. We don't hear the actor's voices. We hear the real people's voices coming out of the actor's mouths. And this is something I think, yeah, we could talk about, is the reenactments, which they certainly fit thematically, because as we've said, this is a movie about a guy who pretended to be someone else and who had a history of passing himself off as other people, playing other roles. Here, everyone we see on screen is played by two people, themselves and then the actors in the reenactment. So I think that's very interesting. And I actually do think that the lip syncing is another interesting sort of thematic element, because you do have someone playing Bourdain. We hear his voice, and it's sort of like, how many levels of people playing other people is there? So that's an actor playing Bourdain who's playing Nicholas, but it's Bourdain's real voice. That's all kind of – that's very interesting stuff. I will say sometimes, like, I can make the argument thematically for the reenactment. Sometimes I have a hard time making the argument for them, like, viscerally. They felt a little slow and sluggish to me. They look nice.
Yeah.
They're really beautiful. They were shot very beautifully with, obviously, like, high-end equipment, or at least a high-end cinematographer who could make it look really good. But sometimes I felt a little bit like I was watching like a really high-end episode of Unsolved Mysteries, you know? And this could have been an Unsolved Mystery episode. And sometimes I almost felt like I might want to see that version because it would have been a little quicker, a little snappier, a little pulpier. There were times when I felt like the movie was kind of pontificating or dawdling a little bit. You have this like amazing crime story, you know, or this amazing mystery. And I almost felt like the reenactments to some degree almost did like a little bit of a disservice to it. It just sort of, it was like I was like in a fog almost. I wanted it to sort of like grab me, and sometimes the reenactments sort of kept pushing me away instead of pulling me in. That was sort of how I felt. Now towards the end of the movie, there's sort of a twist, maybe not a twist, but there's a development in the case, let's say. And at that moment, I really got really interested, and sort of the ending of the movie, the last like 20, 30 minutes of the movie, I think are fantastic.
Yeah.
But I will say that sort of in the middle there, some of the because all these, it's not just reenactments, they're sort of like glacial, like super slow-mo reenactments. Cameras slowly zooming in on something or pulling out or tracking side to side. And it was kind of a lulling effect on me that I wanted to be grabbed more.
Yeah. I actually liked the reenactments. There's a lot of the Errol Morris Thin Blue Line influence to that. And I think, I mean, like, as has influenced a lot of true crime kind of documentaries dealing with these crimes.
Mm-hmm.
But I think for the most part they worked for me because beyond the way the trick of having the vocals and the interviews bleed in, I mean, there's one moment in particular where audio that we've already heard, we understand who said it, you know, and that's done. It's so creepy the way it's done.
Yes.
It like gave me goosebumps.
Yes.
But I think that it does. What I liked about the reenactments, I mean, as they were a little ponderous, I still think that they're so deliberately subjective that I think that they foreshadow that final twist in terms of tone before we ever get there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that we are reminded that we are seeing different people's accounts and that they have their own biases and that they have their own agenda that they're pushing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there are two scenes in particular that I think also called up the weirdness of what was going on. And using like, there's the part where they play the Doobie Brothers song and there's the part where they play Queen Bitch, David Bowie. And both of those, I think, put you a little more in that mindset of being like, yes, here is a 20 something guy, from, you know, European guy who is suddenly now in Texas and leading this like been dropped right into this incredibly American life,
yeah,
you know, and he's getting on a school bus and he's about to go to high school like that. There's something that I think it got to in these representations of that it did really well, rather than just telling this story. Every once in a while really got into that mindset of like, what would it actually be like if you took this life, this guy's life that had been cut short and just jumped back into it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There is some interesting things there about the, as you said, like the subjective nature of this. I mean, it's almost like a Rashomon story in some ways because these people are saying, this is what happened and we were totally fooled. And, you know, and then other people are saying, well, no, you weren't, because clearly XYZ, you know, we don't want to get into it. But we're sitting there in the audience going, how could anyone be fooled by this guy who, he creates this absurd story that, you know, on the surface, anyone would be skeptical about. He claims that there's this huge, massive conspiracy. He
was, military officials.
Yeah, this huge military conspiracy. He was tortured. He was abused. They gave him eye drops to change his eye color.
They made him not speak English.
Right.
That's how he has an accent.
That's why this kid from Texas suddenly has a French accent. And, you know, it's not just the family at first. You know, people go along with it. And I think there is an interesting aspect to the fact that we're sitting there in the audience thinking, well, I would not believe this. And how could anyone believe this? As we're listening to these people, you know, very sincerely explain their reasons and insist that they, you know, it wasn't that they knew, they didn't know. You know, and we might think, well, they just wanted someone to replace their son. And they claim, no, we really thought he was real. Now, whether or not they're in denial, that we could discuss. But it's interesting how the end of the film, I think, not only pulls the rug out from under the story, but I think pulls the rug out from under us and creates this scenario where we are put into a position to start to understand that family better than we had before, because their story seems so implausible. And at the end of the movie, we have done a similar – it's so hard to talk about without spoiling it.
Yeah.
But we've been given a story, and we believe it because we want to believe it. You know what I mean? Does that make sense? Do
yes.
you kind of understand what I'm saying?
Yes.
That's how – that's sort of how it all comes full circle, is that this actual development in the case and the way that Leighton presents it in the film gives us the chance to feel what that's like, to really want to believe something and perhaps to delude yourself into believing it until you make it true, which I thought was really, you know, super, super smart and super, super interesting how formally he does that using all these different tricks.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And I mean, it don't want to go into what happens in the latter
yes,
part of the
film. Very difficult to talk about.
It is
about
really
here.
Difficult. But like that, I mean, it's a new film. I think
no,
you
we
guys
don't want to
check
spoil
it out.
It. Yes.
And like,
yes.
But it definitely also it deals with the ways in which you make assumptions based on also who is the victim in the story, you know? And I think that that's also the case in the story that Bourdain tells, right? He tells the story of grotesque, like terrible things happening to him. He and all these other boys were, you know, being sexually abused. It was this terrible situation. And part of the reason that that story works is because it's so, I think, over the top that it becomes, you would be monstrous to question it, right?
Right. And who would just invent a story like
who,
this?
It's yeah,
so
like what kind of terrible person would
right.
like, you know, think of all of these things and use them.
Yeah.
But that, you know, that it because like our instinct is to want to kind of like protect or shelter or something, you know, like that in many ways, I think the film kind of makes you think about your assumptions about victimization in that way,
right.
because like it's nothing turns out to be so straightforward and that it really shakes you up. Like the last half hour is very disturbing.
Yeah.
In many ways. And, you know, beyond the fact that like you have this whole story being told by someone who is disturbing himself. Like he is someone who,
oh, he's going to write you such a missive on Twitter.
Well, I think he says at the end, I care about myself, just about myself, you know,
oh,
and
man.
That's
you
his
are,
like
you
final
are in for it.
That's I'm, you know, prepared. I'm not going to be bullied into by the subject of this film. No, but I think that like, I mean, that he is someone who's disturbing in those interviews, you
yeah.
know?
I think, I don't, is it a great, great film? I'm not sure it gets quite there. I think it's
yeah.
a very good film. I think it's an incredible story. I think it's absolutely worth seeing. Is it going to be on my top 10 list? Probably not.
Yeah.
I don't know about you.
No, I don't think it will. But I do really appreciate it.
Yeah,
it
is absolutely. And I'm glad
very,
I saw it.
It's very worth a look.
Absolutely. So that is The Impostor. And it is available now on VOD and iTunes.
Okay, we close things out with Behind the Eight Ball, in which we give you a rapid-fire countdown of three picks that are new to streaming, two that are expiring soon, and one pick chosen blindly by number from our Netflix queues. Matt, are you ready?
I am ready.
All right, three new picks.
We picked all new films for our new releases this week, just to keep with our theme. So first up, I've got Something from Nothing, The Art of Rap. This is available now on Netflix. It's the directorial debut of Ice-T. It's a documentary about the history and craft of hip-hop, which, as you know, Allison, I'm an expert on. Next up, I've got The Russian Winter, another music documentary. This one's available on iTunes and Amazon Instant. I saw this film and really liked it at the Tribeca Film Festival. Didn't get a lot of attention, but it's an interesting little film. It's about this guy named John Forte. He worked for years with the Fugees. He was a producer and writer on their big album, The Score. He later got busted smuggling cocaine.
Oops.
He went to jail for several years. Now he's out. And it follows him sort of, you know, not entirely unlike Oslo, August 31st. It's about him kind of picking up the pieces of his life. He's now, you know, out of jail and trying to make something of himself again, get his music career back on track. And this is about his tour through Russia, where he's meeting Russian artists and collaborating with them. It's a really interesting and actually really beautifully shot documentary. Last up, I've got The Color Wheel, also available on iTunes and Amazon Instant. This was voted the best undistributed film of 2011 in IndieWire and Village Voices polls, both film critic polls. Now it's available to download at home. I definitely recommend it. It's by Alex Ross Perry, a guy I used to work with at Kim's Video, actually. It's his second film. It's this very funny but also kind of disturbing movie about two siblings on a road trip. So that's The Color Wheel, available on iTunes and Amazon Instant.
Okay, two expiring films.
Okay, first up, I have one I'd never heard of before, but I'm intrigued, and I have until December 7th to watch it on Netflix. It's called Shadows and Lies. Anything, Allison?
Shadows and Lies?
It's a 2010 film starring James Franco, Julianne Nicholson, and Josh Lucas.
Wow.
Yeah, I've never heard of it, so it must be amazing. Franco plays a man who returns to New York to try to save the woman he loved from organized criminals. That's the Netflix description. These criminals, Allison, are highly organized.
Absolutely.
Yeah, okay, so that's Shadows and Lies, available until December 7th. Available until December 9th on Netflix is the surfing documentary from 2003, Step Into Liquid, directed by Dan Brown, the son of Bruce Brown, who directed the great classic surfing doc, The Endless Summer. Another thing I'm an expert on. Hip-hop and surfing, Allison.
I've always said that about you.
Yes, if there's two things I know, it's hip-hop and surfing. No, I don't know anything about any of those things, but that's why I like these documentaries. I like learning about these subjects that I don't know anything about. I actually do like surfing docs. They're beautiful,
they're
right?
They're gorgeous.
They're just gorgeous. And Step Into Liquid is really one of the most beautiful.
All right, and one from your queue.
You gave me number 31, and this week that is Red Line 7000. This is one of Howard Hawks' final films. It's about stock car racers. It stars James Caan and a pre-Star Trek George Takei.
Wow,
yes.
That's quite a combination.
Yes, Red Line 7000, that's available on Netflix. All right, are you ready for your countdown, Allison?
I am ready.
All right, let's start with three new releases.
Okay, these are all new to Netflix. I'm having a very Netflix-heavy episode. But the first one is The Invisible War. It is Kirby Dick's documentary about rape in the military. It's very well done, if incredibly difficult to watch. It's just brutal.
It's a good film, though.
Yeah, grab a lot of tissues if you're going to watch it. Next is Bernie, which is directed by Richard Linklater. This is really the year's indie sleeper hit. Jack Black plays a small-town Texas mortician who becomes a companion of a cranky, wealthy older widow played by Shirley MacLaine. It's got a very funny Matthew McConaughey in it, and it uses the inhabitants of the town in interviews as this kind of Greek chorus narrating the story.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, Take This Waltz, which we talked about in a past episode, episode 9 of SVU, actually. Sarah Polley's film about a love triangle. Michelle Williams plays a young woman torn between her kind husband, played by Seth Rogen, and an
the
artist.
The dreamy rickshaw driver.
And the artist and rickshaw driver, played by Luke Kirby.
I'm getting chills just thinking about him in that rickshaw.
So those are all now streaming on Netflix.
Okay, two expiring titles.
Okay, expiring on December 7th. If you want, it's a terrible film, but if you want a curiosity, Sarah Palin, The Undefeated.
Oh.
Yes, it amounts to basically a feature-length ad for a presidential campaign that never happened. But it's interesting in that Palin gave the film her blessing. It's adoring of her, but she didn't participate in it. So she's this weird absence in the film that they kind of make do with, like, her audiobook as narration and news footage. So that's expiring from Netflix on December 7th. Expiring on December 16th is Sin Nombre, which is director Cary Fukunaga's directorial debut, a thriller about different people from Central America who've hopped a train to ride to the U.S. border. And he's, you know, since gone on to have like a pretty promising directorial career. So if you want to watch his first film, that is expiring on December 16th.
Okay. And one from your queue?
So you also gave me number 31, and yeah, you picked an embarrassing one, which is The Vampire Diaries. The CW show about vampires and werewolves in Mystic Falls, Virginia. I've watched most of the first season, I have to admit. But
just the first season?
Yeah, I don't know how many seasons they're at right now.
Okay.
It's currently running, but yeah.
Okay.
So I'll let you know if any exciting.
How's that one compare with True Blood, which I know you've also watched?
I mean, really, just one is like wilder and has more sex and nudity on it because it's on HBO.
Right.
But they're both basically insane supernatural melodramas. So, you know, it's I'm not proud. It's Vampire Diaries.
Okay, you know? Well, there you go. All right, it's time to go through our next episode's Listener's Choice Options. We're going to do three more new titles because it is that time of the year. You know, this is all we're talking about. So let's do one more like this, at least, before we get to the end of the year. Our first option is a film I'm really looking forward to seeing. It will be available on Netflix Instant starting on December 4th. It is entitled Alps, and it is the follow-up film to Dogtooth by director Yorgos Lanthimos. He was, I believe, the Filmspotting Golden Brick Award winner for Dogtooth with that film. So This is a film near and dear to the hearts of Film Spotting Nation. The synopsis of this one is, four people offer an unusual service. They take on the role of a deceased loved one to help the bereaved family find closure, but one member of the group travels deeper into this distortion of reality after a 16-year-old tennis player dies. Sounds like it could be a great double feature with The Imposter, Allison.
Yeah, seriously.
I was a big Dogtooth fan.
I was too. We both loved it.
Both loved it. Alps didn't get quite as strong a reception, but still very much looking forward to seeing it. So that's option number one. Allison, what's option number two?
Option number two is The Hole, which is now on Hulu. Technically, I suppose this is a 2012 film because it got kind of an odd long release, but it was originally premiered in 2009. American fantasy horror film directed by Joe Dante, the great Joe Dante, of course, of Gremlins, Piranha, The Howling. It stars Terry Polo, Chris Massaglia, whatever, and Haley Bennett. But it's about a pair of brothers who move to a small town from New York and discover this mysterious hole in the basement that from which bad things come. So this was, I think, originally it was a 3D movie, but obviously Hulu does not have it in those dimensions.
We'll watch but it while we'll blinking it. Our eyes very quickly to
exactly.
simulate 3D effects.
But, you know, Joe Dante is a really great filmmaker,
yes.
So interested to see his latest
definitely,
work.
Definitely, definitely. Okay.
And what's the last pick?
Our last pick is a documentary. It is entitled How to Survive a Plague, which is available now on iTunes and VOD. The film is directed by David France. This is supposed to be an amazing documentary. It's about I'll just read from the official description from the distributor. Story of the brave young men and women who successfully reversed the tide of an epidemic, demanded the attention of a fearful nation, and stopped AIDS from becoming a death sentence. And this is supposed to be a really powerful documentary about that very subject. Supposedly has incredible vintage footage from the period, newsreels and home movies and all that sort of thing. Haven't seen this one yet. This is another one we definitely need to watch before the end of the year. It's going to probably be a lot of people's picks for best documentary of the year. Yeah, so I haven't seen it yet, Allison.
I have not,
but
I've heard nothing but good things.
Yeah, we're running out of time to see these movies, so we definitely need to see that one as well. So that's How to Survive a Plague, and that's available on VOD and iTunes.
Which movie should we review on the next episode of Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit? You can send your pick to svu@filmspottingsvu.com or enter in the poll on the right-hand side of the page at filmspottingsvu.com. Your vote must be received by Monday, December 10th at noon. After that, we'll announce the winner on Twitter at our Twitter account, which is @FilmSpottingSVU. And you'll have all that week to watch the film and then join us for our conversation on next week's episode, which will come out at or around Monday, December 17th.
Film Spotting SVU is also where you can find our show archive, as well as a list of direct links to all the movies we discuss on the show. The Film Spotting SVU remix theme song is by Vince Vandal. Listen to more of Vince's work at vincevandal.com. And we'll be back in 2 weeks with more movie recommendations and the movie review you pick. In the meantime, you can follow me and Allison on Twitter @AllisonWilmore and @MattSinger. Or you can follow the show @FilmSpottingSVU. And that's where we announce the winner of each show's listener's choice and where we've been sharing more streaming suggestions from you guys, the SVU listeners. For Film Spotting, I'm Matt Singer.
And I'm Allison Wilmore. Thanks for listening.